people of Earth, your attention, please. Hello, and welcome back to Big Mouth, the Thinking Time Wasters pop culture talk show. My name's Andrew Harrison, and with me, as ever, is Sean Pattenden, the deadly and single-minded Gamora to my serially incompetent Peter Quill. How you doing, Sean? Busy week?
Yes, thank you. Very well.
We're doing Infinity War this week. You had to do mum duty and take your lad to see Infinity War. Was it a chore or was it a pleasure?
I think it was a combination of both, actually. Yeah.
Yes?
Yeah.
What's the worst mum duty you've had to do regarding films?
March of the Penguins.
March of the Penguins. Oh,
God. With, narrated by Morgan Freeman. One of those really, really early shows, at like 9 o'clock, where they get you in for free and you think, I've got nothing to do, I've got a very, very young child. It was so depressing. Penguin life is really difficult. And I didn't realise. And he kind of just sort of, you know, mused on something. And I was just thinking, my God, you know, this is awful. The penguins, I mean, they have to go miles and miles to get one thing to eat, like a sardine. Then they have to walk miles and miles back.
It's like being in a food desert.
Yeah, it was really depressing.
It's like being in Scamsdale where there's no shops.
It was very similar to that, yeah.
Well, mum duty. My mum actually fell asleep during Jaws when she took us to see Jaws.
Yeah.
And she fell asleep and then woke up like, why is that man being eaten? Great stuff. As ever, we have two special guests this week. Strictly Kev, a.k.a. DJ Food, a.k.a. Kev, is a long-standing member of the Cold Cut Ninja Tune stable. He started out making dance tracks and the famous Jazz Breaks albums with Matt Black and Jonathan Moore of Cold Cut. Then he helped them to create the famous Solid Steel mixes and their classic Journeys by DJ mix. Again, son, harder. Then he graduated to making his own albums and mixes as DJ Food, including most recently The Search Engine. Kev is also a 2000 AD man, a ZTT Records nut who runs the lovely Art of ZTT website, showcasing the artwork from Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Artanoids and Propaganda, and he's a Marvel Comics aficionado, so he can help us deal with the Infinity War later. Hello, Kev. Welcome back to Big Mouth.
Hi, Andrew.
How you doing?
It's great having your life encapsulated like that, isn't it?
I am the hype man. Tell us about artofztt.com then, which is a beautiful repository.
Oh, that's just my collection of ZTT stuff, which basically influenced me as a graphic designer, which is another string to my bow. And I decided this had been rudely ignored in the annals of sort of graphic design history of music.
Yeah.
And somebody should record it. And about 15 years ago, set about collecting bits and pieces, interviewing people like Paul Morley and Lo Cole, who did the Welcome to the Pleasure Dome cover, and just putting all these sleeves, posters, artwork, adverts online as a sort of ongoing project.
It was a brilliant thing because they just didn't like create one advert and run it in 20 magazines. They did a different magazine for every advert with a different quote from Hegel or Nietzsche or whatever pulled out of Paul Morley's ear. And then like beautiful works of art in their own right. And then, oh, look, here's a picture disc with another mix. And there's a quote from Nietzsche in the run-out groove. Yeah. It kind of ruined record sleeves for me because everybody else just goes produced by...
Yes.
Not even that anymore.
Yeah.
You know, boring.
Brand new mix out now, which Paul Morley actually said we are never going to call it the such and such mix after the initial sex mix of Frankie Goes to Hollywood. But also they rarely put the band in the adverts or on the covers as well. So it was, you know, these are number one records, top 10 records.
I may have bored podcast listeners with this before, but I actually got a quote from an Art of Noise record into my English A-level essay and got top marks. And, oh, you've been reading very widely, Andreas. I actually just got off the back of an Art of Noise record. So I actually owe my A-level to the Art of Noise. What's your favourite ZTT bit?
I do actually own the artwork to Welcome to the Pleasure Dome. The original.
You own the original artwork?
Yeah, the front, back and inside covers.
Flipping F.
So I bought that a long time ago from the artist. So
good
that's
Lord.
Quite a prize.
You haven't got the Jean Genet boxer shorts sold with Pleasure Dome. Because Frankie Goes to Hollywood also invented emojis, didn't they? All those little kind of, the little man and the heart and the... And the tadpole. What was that? The little tadpole.
That was the sperm.
No, it wasn't. It was a tadpole.
Also with us on the show, he's a former staff member of Arena Magazine and The Faced. Now he's swapped fancy cufflinks and geometric haircuts for the bucolic smell of whittling wood and the comforting rustle of a handmade coracle. As the editor of Hole and Corner Magazine, the periodical of craftsmanship and heritage, hello, Mark. Welcome back to Big Mouth.
Thank you.
How's your week been?
Very hectic, actually. So I'm sure you all know London Craft Week. It's coming up next week, and we're sort of teaming up with Dunhill. We don't just do like hand whittling and old fashioned stuff, but we're taking over their flagship store in Mayfair, Burden House. They're the main sponsors of London Craft Week, so it's quite a major deal for us. And we've got sort of makers in every floor. We've got a really famous, world famous glass maker blowing glass in their courtyard. They've got a cinema in the basement, so it's a huge program of events going on. And we're also launching a major emerging talent prize as well. And we've commissioned some specific pieces which are going to be auctioned off there as well for that as well. So yeah, it's been pretty mad. So we suddenly become like an events company as well.
Sounds
so
very busy.
Holeandcorner.com, it's all up there.
So what kind of things are the makers making?
And what's new? What's new in making?
I mean, this is because it's with Dunhill, it's all about, you know, their sort of history of craftsmanship and how it's relevant and contemporary today. So obviously they've got their leather makers and their tailors, but then we've got this amazing guy called Florian Gadsby. He's a ceramicist, potter, but he's got like amazing, huge Instagram following. There's a whole world of Instagram craft makers, and he's kind of like the leader of it. And they've got a little rotunda room, which they normally use as their sort of, you know, their showroom. And he's sitting there throwing pots and stuff.
So Florian is doing craft work. I'm very excited by this.
Yes, exactly.
It's a little neon sign.
Yeah,
yeah,
and you know, loads of Michael Rue, who's an amazing glass blower and makes like really kind of exclusive pieces for perfumers and stuff, and he's the guy working in the courtyards. He's going to be swinging like hot glass and
it's quite high end. Then it's not just
very
Hessian,
it's very much aimed,
you know.
At, I mean, we sort of feature everybody. It's about kind of making in general. So we're not Luddite, you know. We do support kind of people who use computers and stuff, but
only wooden computers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Steam powered.
Made out of bamboo. Yeah. Does the Hole and Corner ethos intersect with any rock bands? We'd imagine Belle and Sebastian or British Sea Power or Julian Cope being into this sort of thing. Can you see it?
Well, yeah, I mean, again, melding? I think my personal taste tends to veer towards the electronic, so it doesn't really fit with that. But we do quite a lot of events. We've done Port Elliot Festival for the last 3 or 4 years, and we have a sort of music programme going along with that. So Moshi Moshi Records put on people for us. So they're kind of, you know, up and coming bands. Quite a lot of bands who end up on Heavenly, those sort of kind of interesting indie, quirky.
You could also have Hole and Corner Shop.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, together.
I wonder why they affect Courtney Love on poor old bands. Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
Maybe not.
They could hold their own, I'm sure.
Yeah. So what else have we got on the show this week, Andrew Harrison?
Well, I'm glad you asked me, Sean Pandon. Of course, we've got Avengers Infinity War, the universe-shattering culmination of 10 years and 18 movies in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Warning, the conversation will be full of spoilers, so we're going to do it at the end of the show so that you can fast forward if you need to, with a special crossover cameo featuring Ian Dunt from our sister show, Romaniacs. It'll be just like when the She-Hulk joined the Fantastic Four. Also, we've got Barry, a dark new comedy from HBO, which has just started on Sky Atlantic. Comedian Bill Hader of Saturday Night Live fame plays a hitman who loses his murder mojo and decides to retrain as an actor. Plus, Janelle Monáe's new album, Dirty Computer. Does she just need one of those lime-scented wet wipe things, you know? Or maybe one of those ear-cleaning jobs to get the keyboard dirt out? And
Hand-compressed air,
absolutely, yes. Oh,
okay.
And the latest addition to these Too Slow to Disco series of compilations, this one covering Brazil with an S. So we're going to be diving right into all that after this message.
Are you doing your bit to keep Big Mouth in rude health? Sorry for being so indelicate, but we could use a small contribution to cover our studio costs, and you can help us by buying a symbolic non-real pint on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. If 120 listeners pledge just £5 a month, it will cover all our studio costs. That's a month of shows for the cost of a slightly overpriced fancy IPA in an artisan London drinkery. And once we hit the target, we'll start recording extra bits each week for our Patreon backers. Our appreciation would be boundless. So go to patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast to find out more. The link is at the top of the Big Mouth Facebook page too. All we're saying is buy us a pint.
And if you listen closely, you can see the virtual pipe being poured.
Well, you could.
Okay, let's get going. Let's get started with Barry, HBO's comedy drama starring Bill Hader, which has just started on Sky Atlantic. The premise couldn't be simpler. A disillusioned hitman is assigned to a job in Los Angeles, and when he gets there, like every single person who ever went to LA ever, he realises that his true calling is to be an actor. Does this black comedy work, and does it show that all jobs, even the ones that involve high adventure, leave us wishing we were doing something else for a living? Let's have a taster.
You want to know what I'm good at? I'm good at killing people. It's a job. The money's good. But lately, that depressed feeling is back.
This looks like the old Barry. What do you say to a little trip out to sunny Los Angeles?
I followed Ryan yesterday.
The guy you were supposed to burn?
Yeah, he went to this theater to take an acting class, and I end up doing a scene with all of them. Action!
My queen, the lord, my lord, the queen is dead.
Take your hands out of your pocket. Don't slump.
I need you to surrender.
Point is, I was really good.
Go to. You have known what you should not.
Stop. I'm not kidding. You're making me nauseous.
Bill Hader as Barry, discombobulated hitman who's contracted to go to Los Angeles and finds himself at an actor's workshop playing opposite the man he must kill. It's totally Hitchcock to me. And thus the story begins, which is what you say when you're aware that anything you might say next could be a massive spoiler. Henry the Fonz Winkler is in it, and there are jokes about hitting your mark. See? Hitman, actor, all the way through. I hope there are lots more to come, as I'm going to watch all of it, all of it. And it's really exciting because it's episode by episode. You can't just binge watch. Yeah. Mark, did you get it? Mark, did you believe in Bill Hader's Hitman?
I thought it was brilliant. Yeah, I really loved it. It felt really fresh. And there's been a lot of kind of hype about a lot of Sky Atlantic shows coming out, and I haven't got a Sky, so, and I actually was kind of quite happy to, I don't know what it's called, TV Go, was it? Whatever, I had to pay Murdoch to watch it. But it was, yeah, it was fantastic, I thought. And the thing I love about it is he's got such a dreary existence, and he's a really boring character. And that's such really like, your central character is this guy who's basically got no personality. And that's kind of the big joke with the acting thing, is he's a terrible actor. And to be able to act being a terrible actor, and then they think he's a brilliant actor when he's actually not acting. Just to be able to sort of combine that, all that.
That kind of studied blankness is the thing of now, isn't it? Yeah. You know, when, what's his name? Drive. His name escapes me.
Ryan Gosling.
When Ryan Gosling walks around with a blank face on, people go, oh my God, it's the new Brando. There's nothing there.
And he's, I mean, it's, the other thing is, like, you know, quite often the sort of films portray the hitman as being the sort of glamorous, and he's got a horrible, boring existence. He lives in sort of motels and lives like a teenager, and he's like playing video games and stuff. Yeah. And then his fixer comes along and is basically trying to like get him out of a rut and stuff. Come on, we can kill somebody. Or something. I've got a new job for you. It's going to be really exciting. Take you to LA and get away from here.
So it flips it, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
That's the thing. Is his life is, he needs affirmation. He's got to get it from somewhere. What did you think of Henry Winkler, the Fonz, being the hardened acting coach?
I thought he was really good. He's sort of had a bit of a mini revival of late, hasn't he? He's sort of cropped up a few times. I've seen him being interviewed. And yeah, I think he's perfect for it because he's, you know, it's good to have a recognisable character, and he's, you know, he's not the typical Fonz. He's quite irascible and the brilliant thing is he kind of gets duped by basically Barry Lewis. Barry's an amazing name for a star of a show as well. I've got a builder called Barry.
Are you sure he's a builder?
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly.
just put the hit out on you. Get the guy from a hole and
I think you needed someone like Henry Winkler because he was so, Barry was so, had such little personality.
Yeah.
And the Fonz just steams in and basically steals it for me because he's directionless, isn't he? Barry needs a purpose and he's looking for a purpose and he finds a purpose.
He needs a mentor, doesn't he?
He was looking for a job and then he found a job.
Would you jack it all in, Kevin, to run off with a gang of troubadours? Is this selling the life to you that actually acting is a really good thing and we shouldn't be laughing at it?
I wouldn't actually, because I just think he's taken in by the whole LA glitz, isn't he? You know, there's the scene at the end where he's in the diner and he says, oh, what's that? And she says, oh, I'm an actor. You know,
yeah.
So am I, sort of, you know, closing shot. But I found his motives really, really thin. He falls for the girl that he meets, the actress. That's the setup. I mean, it was a little bit vague, but there was these sort of long stares of affection at her on stage and the sort of slow-mo shot.
And I think you're right about that. The fact that he's a man with no personality, surrounded by people with outsized personalities, and he wishes he was like them. And you know, TV and movies are fascinated with the culture of Hollywood, people trying to make it. You know, it's like films about films and writers writing about writing. What I really liked about this is it didn't outright mock the actors. The wannabe actors. It presented them as like honest dreamers with a possibly doomed but positive outlook on life and really likable. And part of Barry's story is he's an Iraq vet, you know, veteran, not troop of animals. He's a veteran of Iraq, and it's like he's come home with having had his personality removed by his experiences, and to be amongst these outsized, possibly naive, but charismatic and likable individuals is. It's where he wants to be.
But I think he's been duped. There's the moment where he's on stage and he's looking, they're all applauding, and he's almost like, oh. And they say he's good. They're probably just bullshitting him, you know, anyway. But he's taken in, but there might be something here. There might be something here. He's duped into it almost. And because Henry Winkler falls for the whole monologue, which he thinks is a monologue.
I was going to ask about that. Yeah. So Barry has this speech, which is, what it's doing is riffing on Oscar speeches in films, you know, where that's the exposition. This is who I am. This is what I want to be. And it's his real tale. And Henry Winkler thinks he's making it up and he's just auditioning for the acting troupe.
Yeah.
Did you think that sometimes the postmodernism was getting too clever for its own good, or do you fall for that idea?
I like that bit.
Yeah.
That was the bit that turned it for me. I really, really thought, oh, right, okay, he's got something here.
I read that Bill Hader redid that scene. So he had done that monologue, but actually the monologue wasn't good enough when they got to putting it out on air. So you're seeing Henry Winkler is reacting to the old speech, but he's actually doing the speech more emotive and more something
than
the other.
This is a bit too much metaphor, Misha. So the fake acting wasn't fake enough, so he redid
the fake acting. But we still have the genuine Henry Winkler.
To be more really fake. Okay.
Yeah.
I love the fact also that his fixer, or whatever he's called, the guy who kind of sets up his hits for him, when he says, I think I found what I want to do, he's trying to work it out. So I think I'm probably freelance and I can do both. I can be a hitman and be an actor. He's like, being an actor is probably the worst job you can probably
do. Your job is to be
anonymous and turn up and kill people and disappear again.
Wonderful gag when he says, yeah, but you're going to be on adverts and people are going to see your face. You're going, I'm not going to do adverts.
Yeah.
That's one of the acting thing.
Because he's got, like we all do when we sort of daydream, go, maybe I'll give it all up and be a chef. And within a minute, you've sort of like thought about your 30 restaurants across the world. And
your integrity.
I won't do this, I won't do that.
I'll be cooking with meat.
I believe in locally sourced, all this kind of stuff. He's just spun off into the world of his own.
It's a very good setup episode, really. Mm. I mean, it was literally the setup, wasn't it? There wasn't a lot there to get your teeth into. Yeah. And given that end scene, which I don't know if we can talk about.
Let's not really.
Several of the characters
show another side of themselves.
Yes. And there's a lot more to come, you can tell.
What I loved about it, many things I loved about it, I think he's a fantastic... I love his blankness because he's like... That's like a modern acting performance in the context of a lot of other characters who are giving old-fashioned acting performances. They think that acting is to be outsized. I loved that. I love the fact that it's half an hour long.
Mm.
I am drowning in hour-long... longers-filled
really
Netflix stuff. I love the fact, as you said, Sean, it's weekly.
Yeah.
So you can't just gorge on it. You've got to... I love a cliffhanger.
Yes. I thought, I've got a few days to think about this. And I was thinking about it, when's it out? Was it Friday? And it was a bit like an event thing.
But the other thing I loved about it is Janet from The Good Place from The Good Place.
Yes.
Janet, the kind of human Cyborg computer helper from The Good Place, is in it as one of the actors. And it made me think, these are all kind of quite accomplished people. Why do they want to go back to school, make a film about what they had to do to get where they are? And it made me think that perhaps acting school in Los Angeles isn't the tragic bore that we've been told by fiction for years and years, full of losers and failures. Actually, it's really great.
Mm.
They're all supportive of each other and they're all having a really good time. Mm. And that's the world that, like, Barry wants to be in and isn't and can't be because his job is shooting people.
I definitely got the impression that they were all going to be failures. I don't think any of them... That's what I liked about it. There wasn't this glitzy, you're all going to make it. You just think they've got a bit of sadness.
But I was
thinking, they're nice people, and
it's going to ruin it if they are. If anyone gets successful within that troupe, obviously, then they have to stay unsuccessful for the sitcom to work.
But then if he gets successful, that's where it all starts to unravel. Build. Surely he's going to be some mega star. Hopefully.
This is why I wish almost all films would end after Act One, because I've seen the situation. I don't want it to go wrong. End of Act One, something goes wrong. Horrible things happen to the people you've been made to like.
Someone gave me some brilliant advice. He said, never watch any box sets, just watch Episode One, so you know what people are talking about. You can join in the conversation in the pub, but you don't have to...
Don't waste your life.
I think it's fair to say we really love this, didn't we?
I thought it was brilliant, and I revelled in thinking all the different directions it could go in, which I think is a mark of something quite good.
I'm going to be watching the shit out of this one. Let's have a bit of music. As always, we invite our guests to bring in a tune to play, the editor's recommendation, as it were. Mark Hooper, what have you got for us?
Yeah, a bit of a curveball in a way. Alexis Taylor, who is the singer in Hot Chip, he put out an album. We actually, talking of Craft Week, another plug, we did an event with him a few years ago where we worked with Steinway Pianos, and they stripped a grand piano back to its basics and then restrung it, and then he came and played, and he had a new album out at the time called Piano, which was quite convenient. And that was all kind of like, standard sort of ballads and Motown songs and stuff. And it was almost like, I think he was trying to make a point that he's actually got a really good voice and he's quite soulful and gets a bit hidden in the mix and some of the stuff he does. And this new album is much more electronic, but quite down tempo. It's just really, his voice really comes to the fore, and he's got a really lovely sort of tone to his voice, which I'd never really sort of appreciated before. And there's one song, it's just kind of a ridiculously chirpy, upbeat song called Oh Baby. I actually thought it sounded like some obscure krautrock song at the beginning. It's really bugging me what it was, but it's actually Temporary Secretary by Paul McCartney. Right. It's got this weird electronic beginning. And then it just goes into a really ridiculous upbeat pop song. And with everything going on at the moment, I think we need a bit more of that in our lives.
Okay, well, let's have a listen. This is Alexis Taylor with Oh Baby.
Oh baby, when you lose control, you make me feel like I found my soul. Oh baby, when I see your smile, it breaks the heart of this little child.
Baby by Alexis Taylor from his new album Beautiful Thing, the choice of Mark Hooper. More music. Yes, yes, Janelle Monáe is the new Prince, we all know that, but is her long-awaited new album Dirty Computer as good as everybody seems to want it to be? And is her out and proud polysexual rampageousness matched by equally good tunes? We're going to find out after this track. This is the immensely filthy sound of Pink.
Ah, Miss Moneypenny, we've been expecting you. Pink by Janelle Monáe from Dirty Computer. In the video, she dresses as a huge, funky, dancing vagina while singing about tongues going down and stroking a furry brown thing. What's not to like? Imagine Sun Ra coming back as a digital Beyoncé at some Great Gatsby-style party, with the ghost of Prince serving really strong martinis with bits of actual gold in them, and everyone snogging in a swimming pool in tiny gold chainmail shorts. That's what the album sounds like to me a bit. It's like I'm powerful and a little bit tender, an emotional sexual bender, she sings on Make Me Feel. Kevin Folks, how wild and free and relaxed and groovy did you feel after listening to Janelle Monáe?
I felt really old, actually. It's, you know, I watched the emotion in commas picture as well.
She's made a movie to go with it, hasn't
she? Yeah, which is a 45-minute version of the album, which is great, actually. Has shades of THX-1138 and One Further to Cuckoo's Nest sort of mind-sapping stuff going on, interspersed with videos. And it's sort of not aimed at me because I'm in my late 40s and it's very, very teen, young, free, single. I really liked it overall as a record, but I can't see me going back to too much of it. Although I think Make Me Feel is one of the best singles of the year, hands down.
Definitely.
And it almost throws virtually the rest of the album into shade. It's so good. It's really, really that good. I know she steals from Prince, both visually and sonically, it's so good.
I never understand why people moan about her borrowing from Prince, because we never moan when artists borrow from the Beatles or Elvis or the Rolling Stones. It's like or Kraftwerk. You know, these are set texts. These are primary colours. There's no problem in...
But didn't he play on it anyway? He played keyboards on it, apparently.
There's a bit of Prince in there somewhere.
Yeah. So, you know... Whatever, you know. But I think that song Pink, as much as I dislike it melodically, it's going to just be a classic of the genre, because that video, who can forget that? I mean, it's the minute you see it, you're just like, oh, right, her tongue's firmly in cheek here.
It's somewhere. The kids,
and everywhere else.
The kids are certainly wearing vagina pants up and around the road where I live.
Are they really?
Yeah, all of them. Well, yeah. I live in Dalston.
Mark, what did you think? Do you think this is a political album as much as it's a let's be relaxed and funky?
Yeah,
and...
absolutely. I mean, I feel almost complete opposite to Kevin. I'm similar age, and I've got to a stage where I'm like regretfully kind of moving on from Radio 1 and sort of thinking it's probably not really aimed at me anymore. But yeah, I think it's amazing. I think she's amazing. I think it's an album she really needed to make, and I think that exactly that's the point. She's become very politicised in the last few years with the Women's March and the Black Lives First movements, and she always kind of hid behind a character when she first came, and I didn't really engage with her, and there's this sort of, you know, clever robotic, a bit like what Bjork used to do, but I didn't really think it was as good as what Bjork used to do, and now she's kind of like let the guard down, shown who she really is, and I love the way it's dressed up like a big dumb pop album, and it's very princey. I mean, there's some obvious pastiches, as Kevin mentioned, and the last song, Americans, is kind of Let's Go Crazy, basically. But the entire album feels to me like a print. It's all, you know, genre and gender bending, you know, everything, you know, everything goes into the mix. I found it really surprising. It's really exciting. Also, Kevin was talking about Thank You, Tom, it really reminded me of those early ZTT albums.
Oh, like, can you imagine Janelle Monáe on ZTT? Exactly.
Oh, that's a good idea, isn't it?
I mean, she's got Brian Wilson already. You know, the other thing is, like, she's got the right, like, she doesn't just do a B Beach Boys pastiche, she gets Brian Wilson to write it for
Yeah, but where was he? I mean,
you
he
can
was,
hardly hear
he
him.
Was slightly over
he
in
doesn't
the
have
line
anyway, speaker, does he? Really? He probably arranged it or something. Yeah. You know?
He's more of a sample of himself.
But likewise, Prince, I mean, Prince was her mentor, and she talks about how cut up she was when he died, and that kind of helped her to finish the album because she thought, I've got to, you know, got to. Mm. She used to ring him up for advice, and now I haven't got him for advice anymore. And I just think,
phone.
Yeah, I just think it feels like an exciting album. And also there's a lot of political stuff about America. And, you know, they make a point about, you know, the Declaration of Rights. The far right are trying to reclaim all of that territory. And she's saying it's also about the pursuit of pleasure. You know, that's written into our constitution.
It's definitely,
you know,
a record for now. Isn't
yeah,
it?
And it's kind of, yeah, I love the reaction. There's a song called Screwed where her reaction is, you know, let's get screwed. And there's lots of, you know, you've effed the world up. Let's set it back again.
I don't know if it's in that track or another one, but it's like the message is like, you fuck it all up, we're going to fuck it back down again.
Exactly.
It's like a brilliant line.
Yeah. And she says, I'm not America's nightmare, I'm the American dream.
Yeah.
She wants to be part of it. She's not just saying F you. She's saying, look, I can be part of the future. If you embrace me and we can move together, then everybody gets on a lot better.
Yeah,
and
she's kind of saying,
I like that. She's not set against it. She wants to be part of it.
Yeah, there's like she's two sides of the debate. She's saying, this is my America and I'll defend it as much as you will. Yeah.
There's a thing in the video where she's got some pants on that say, I grab back.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I loved it, but it's just not for me totally. Yeah. Mm. But I think it's the album that she's been threatening to make for a long time. I'm amazed that she wasn't bigger earlier, because when Tightrope came out, I thought, well, this is just the next superstar, surely. Mm. And then it didn't quite go as super stratospheric as I thought, but this one will. Crazy Classic Life. That's just got Coke advert written all over it. And she's got that sort of Katy Perry-esque sort of level of synth pop.
It's hits, isn't it?
It's such a young person's album, you know, and the messages that are underlying it, fantastic. Yeah. You know, and you look at the video and she's with a guy, she's with a girl, it doesn't matter.
Well, there's been loads of sort of like classic, you know, gay male pop over the past few decades that's actually explained gay culture to people who aren't gay. You know, it's like, it's your gateway. We'll talk about Frank Goes to Hollywood, you know, you know, Communards and all, but, you know, Pet Shop Boys. It's explained it to those of us who are, like, not in that world and given you, like, your doorway to understanding another kind of, you know, another way of being. I think this is the same thing for, you know, queer lady pop, you know. It's like, okay, the think pieces are massing over our heads right now, and many of them will be really boring and really kind of joyless.
Most of them be really
but she's like, I think Mark's right, you know, the pursuit of pleasure is an important thing, and she's being everything that she wants to be. It's really kind of, it's massively sexy and massively assertively sexy, which I think is really different and modern.
I think she does overdo it on that a little bit. It's a little bit like when Janet Jackson and Madonna went sexy.
I quite like that. She's just pushing it.
Oh, yeah. It's not sleazy in any way, but she does. I think there's about three choruses where the F word is part of the actual chorus.
Well, it reminded me of Madonna a lot. And there's the bit in, which I can't remember the song, I'm sure someone will correct me, everything is sex except sex, which is power. You know, power is just sex. You screw me and I'll screw you too. That's really Madonna of the mid-90s. There's nothing that isn't. Yeah. And I didn't mind that. I quite liked it being just so in your face. And that sexuality is political. It's also cultural as well. It's, you know,
It feels quite bold and almost dangerous to hide all that in a pop record. But then when you think about what she's referencing, Madonna, Prince, they're all doing it in the 80s. And it's weird, like, that's sort of fallen by the wayside, and it's almost like she's kind of reclaiming.
But one of the things I like about it is it's not, a lot of the kind of 80s allegedly sex positive records were like, hey, sex is great, it keeps you really healthy, it's good for your mind, it's like eat your greens, have lots of sex, kids. And this is not like that at all.
No.
This is like, be filthy, do what you want and who you want.
It's pretty explicit, but I actually like it when it's more ambiguous. I thought the ambiguity of Pink was way, way stronger than the Let's Get Screwed kind of thing.
And you said that sort of tongue in cheek, but there's a bit when she said, Pink like the folds of my brain, and she kind of delays saying brain, so, you know, it's just little bits of that, which really reminded me of Prince, because there's that sort of like kinkiness and perviness. But
the message at the end is, we're all pink inside, which is a great general sort of realisation.
And she mentions her therapist in it, you know, so we do get back down to earth. It's almost a bit where she does her shopping, but not quite.
We need more pervs in pop, don't we?
More pervs in pop.
Excellent.
Perv pop power.
We loved it.
Yeah, we definitely did. Let's have a change of gear. Strictly, Kev, what track have you brought in for the listeners, please?
I'm going back to the old school, to 1980 here, for a single that I found in a bargain bin a few months back called Caliber Cuts, which is masterminded by Morgan Kahn. It's one of those disco mix cut-up things. For anyone who's over 40, probably you've heard the Street Sounds albums, you've grown up with the Electro albums. Morgan Kahn was the guy behind that, and he started out as a plugger for Pi Records, and he signed Rapper's Delight, Sugar Hill Gang over here. And he had his finger so on the pulse that he basically made a cut-up record before Grandmaster Flash. And it's from the UK, and it's from 1980. And Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel came out in 1981. This is a disco cut-up of...
So are you saying it's official, Britain invented hip-hop? Vulcan no. Khan invented hip-hop and Cool Herc get to the back of the queue.
Someone from Britain put out the first cut-and-paste DJ Megabits.
That's all I'm saying. Yes, that's like a proper politician's going, mistakes were made, and if you were...
There's another little chapter to write into history.
Fantastic. Well, this is Caliber Cuts by Caliber Cuts. Caliber Cuts by Caliber Cuts, which sounds like an amazing place to get your haircut somewhere in the middle of Dalston. Moving on. Back in 2014, a German DJ called DJ Supermarkt realised that the coked-out, open-shirted, critically loathed yacht rock genre of the American 1970s was essentially disco. Four volumes later, the Too Slow to Disco compilation series is branching out with a new version, Too Slow to Disco Brazil, with an S, featuring similarly unknown tracks from the golden age Brazilian AOR, some of which are so rare they're not even on Discogs. How does this one shape up? We're going to find out after Sandra Sá with Guarda Minha Voz. I have no idea what that means.
Se você deixar a mania de sofrer, nada será.
That was Sandra Sá with Guarda Minha Voz. Apparently means keep my voice, or maybe I'll keep quiet, or stop trying to speak Portuguese, Andrew. Strictly Kev, you're a crate digger. You've come across the Too Slow to Disco genre before.
I have, but I'm not a big Brazilian fan. I hadn't heard of any of this stuff at all.
Right. Did you know the previous Too Slow to Disco series?
I do know them, yeah.
Yeah, I always liked them. What do you think?
Yeah, that's all right. I mean, it's the perfect description for that kind of music. It literally is slow disco, you know. And if you're into that, you're into that. And I know many people that are. It's not really my bag. Yeah. This was even less my bag.
Less your bag, yeah. The original Too Slow to Disco is very LA. And it's loads of lush strings and the idea that you just walk into the party like you're stepping off a yacht, etc., etc.
It's very early 80s, this compilation as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Production's really, really twinkly and zingy, and there's lots of slap bass and...
Yeah, it's a bit more... This is a bit more look at me, a bit more, hey, come on, pay attention. There's loads of bongos and loads of orchestras. What I found hard to connect with is... It might sound a bit pathetic, but it's in Portuguese. Mm. Consequently, the sort of darkness that made some of those Too Slow to Disco early volumes, which kind of refers to like the sort of emptiness of the Coke spoon life and, you know, oh, I'm so bored in my condo in the Hollywood Hills, isn't life dreadful? You don't actually get that window into it. So consequently, it sounded a little bit Seaside Special to me.
It did, yeah. Very summery.
Mark, what did you think?
Yeah, it was all a little bit too smooth for me, really. I do...
Too smooth for you? I don't believe it.
Funny enough, my first ever job was at Acid Jazz. In the genre, there was a lot of Brazilian music going on at that time, and they owned the Blue Note Club, so they had everything from metalheads to smooth jazz sort of nights and stuff. There's some Brazilian stuff like Milton Nascimento I really love, and he's got a song called Para Lennon McCartney, which is about Lennon McCartney. And I don't see Portuguese. I don't think he's entirely happy. it's kind of like a tribute to them, but he's basically saying there's something else in the world apart from Western pop. And it's big and bombastic and really thrilling. And Paul Weller's ripped it off loads of times in his instrumentals and stuff. It's got a real distinctive sound. And there's none of that. It's like it's all been sort of EQ'd out. So there's just this like smooth gloss over everything. And I found it's presented in a slightly tongue-in-cheek way as well, which I didn't really, you know, it reminded me of that kind of cheesy listening sort of thing, which happened.
So what I liked about the original volumes of Too Slow to Disco is it took the cheese out of it. Yeah. And they were beautifully designed. And certainly Volume 1 is an incredible record. by the way, an incredible record made of music. I would generally say I hate it. You know, I'm not a yacht rock guy, but it was so beautifully sequenced and selected, and the songs were so clever. My problem with this is that, like I say, there just isn't really much of a way into it, because you're kind of confused about what the, you know, who are these people, what are they saying, what are they doing? And also, it's very high-toned, very up and let's party. There's not much of a sine wave on the go there. Sean, I'm going to take a wild guess and that you didn't like this record.
I mean, I think in theory, sounded quite good. Easy listening. I quite like a bit of easy listening. And yet I put it on and I think, well, I put it on in the background. And I'll just sort of look at the kitchen. And then I turn it off because it got annoying. And then I put it on again. And then I turn it off because it got annoying again. It's the Love Boat element for me. It just goes somewhere where I don't want to go.
There is a fine line between sophisticated cocktail party on the beach and bad singles resort club music, isn't there?
It's kind of, it did chug along on the same level. I found there was no variety.
Maybe
by track 12,
it.
I was done with it, really. I was, how many more to go?
Yeah. I sort of wonder if there's a thing here where the stuff that was compiled in the original Too Slow to Disco is all about, like, having it all and the kind of emptiness thereof. I'm a rich LA guy and my woman, you know, has just run off with one of the Allman Brothers, that kind of thing. So there's a narrative and a sense of place there that you can get your head around. Whereas, you know, not to sort of like try and imprint too much on the world of Brazil, but, you know, it's a much more impoverished country, a much more desperate country. And I wonder whether the dream that's embodied in this record is like, this is what we all want. This is what we wish we had. Whereas the kind of American Too Slow to Disco is, this is what I've got and look how empty it is.
Yeah.
I need to do a crash course in Portuguese is what I need to do, so I can then understand what I'm finding wanting here.
Yeah, there could be enormous poetry in it that we're all missing.
Well, the best thing for me was I actually looked up yacht rock genre and I thought, where did this come from? And I didn't realise that it was a creation of a comedy sketch, 5-minute comedy sketches that was called Yacht Rock from 2005, which then was riffing off, you know, Hall & Oates, the Doobie Brothers, Michael McDonald, Kenny Loggins and all that sort of stuff. And then it was such a hit that the name went into sort of record store parlance as this is what the genre's called.
Yeah, it ceased to be a joke and became, well, there's many a true word spoken in YouTube video jest, isn't there? Yeah. I got to say, I did prefer the original volume of Too Slow to Disco. Kev, is there a danger in crate digging in that you start to like any old rubbish as long as it's rare? This is terrible, but there's only one of it.
Yes, you know? Yes, and it costs £1,000, yeah. There's always that danger. The blinkers go on. You're like, well, it's rare. It's expensive. It must be good.
I mean, I'm in no way educated in this, but I do like to dig into old reggae. And I just wonder whether, like, that, you know, that scene will be mined out one day. I mean, they were banging out 10 tracks a day in 30 studios across Jamaica for 25 years, 30 years. But there's going to come a point when there is no more King Tubbies to be found.
The thing is, you're always surprised in music and things like that. There's always things coming up. You know, that Caliber Cuts thing that I dug up earlier. You know, I've been into music like that for 3 decades nearly, and I'd never heard of it. And I went to a DJ thing at the weekend where there were about 15 other DJs, played it, they all rushed over, what the hell is this? You know, likewise, they'd never heard of it. And it's like, it's from Britain, it's from 1980. They're like, what? You know, there's always something.
Okay, as promised, we're going to finish up with Avengers Infinity War, the massive multi-character climax of 10 years of Marvel Comics adaptations. Beware, this will be a spoiler-heavy item, so if you haven't seen the film yet, but are planning to, you might want to fast-forward towards maybe 2 or 3 minutes before the end of the show. What do we think? What works? Who dies, if anybody? And what's going to happen next? Here is a taster.
The entire time I knew him, he only ever had one goal. To wipe out half the universe. If he gets all the Infinity Stones, he can do it with the snap of his fingers. Just like that.
Tell me his name again.
Thanos.
Avengers Infinity War. If you haven't seen it, go away, because there will be spoilers. Also, stepping up from the astral plane to join us for this final segment, he's a man out of time, trapped in a world he never made. It's Ian Dunt, editor of politics.co.uk, regular on our sister podcast, Romaniacs, and massive comics nerd. Hello, Ian.
Hello.
You just couldn't keep away, could you?
I couldn't. You made an offer which involved no money and lots of time, and I...
How many times have you seen Infinity War now, you huge man-child?
Twice.
Twice.
I saw it once on Friday. Friday night when I was quite drunk and I just couldn't really take it in. And then I saw it on Sunday morning, completely sober, didn't need to go to the loo at all, and I was a bit more emotionally prepared for the whole experience.
Yeah, well, it takes a lot of emotional preparation, which we'll deal with in a minute. The setup of the movie is very simple. After 10 years of looking for the omnipotent Infinity Stones, Thanos, big horrible purple Thanos, nearly has the full set, and now he's coming to Earth to get the last ones. It all hinges on whether the Avengers will sacrifice the Vision, who has the Mind Stone embedded in his head. By the way, I loved the meta level. Thanos is basically a collector. He just wants to get the set. He's like a comic book guy. Got, want.
He's going to bag them as well.
He's got to bag it up. I can swap you the Soul Stone for Frank Worthington, Newcastle United, 1978, and a gold Luton Town sticker from the Football 79. I envisage Thanos with the Infinity Stones putting them all on a plastic backing on a shelf at home, and Mrs. Thanos saying, Jesus Christ, will you stop wasting the money on these Infinity Stones? Anyway.
You've had a glove made now.
You had a better bloody glove. Yeah. Oh, you can make a glove, but you can't take the bins out. Strictly Kev. Yes. What was your reaction to Infinity War?
Have you been preparing
for this for some time?
I loved it. I've watched all the films, bar Black Panther, I think is the only one I've missed. Mm-hmm. It's amazing what they managed to do with that amount of characters, that amount of story. I actually think they went further than I thought they would. I thought they'd leave it on more of a cliffhanger where he still had to acquire another stone at least, held over to the other film. And I was amazed that he got them all and did what he did.
Yes. And he completed that level of that particular game show. Yes.
I really have to take my hat off because it's keeping a small country of CGI animators in business and work. Yes.
The credits go on for about half an hour.
The credits are insane,
And of course, we all watch them because we're waiting for the end of credits.
We're waiting for the
little hint of Captain Marvel, which we may talk about a little bit later. Was there anything you disliked about it? Anything you found? Because there's a lot going on.
I actually didn't hate any of it. Mm. Honestly, it was a perfect popcorn film. It was the culmination of everything. Two things I have a problem with. Thanos' motive is rubbish. He's going to destroy half the universe. He's got all this power. And he's going to just destroy half of it because he hasn't got enough resources. Make some more resources.
Well, let's park that for a moment because I think we can talk about that in some detail shortly, which is good because we've got Ian from politics.co.uk. Maybe we can discuss the political economy of the destruction of the universe. I don't know. But before we get into that, was there another thing you did?
There's another thing. Where was Adam Warlock?
Well, that's... We're going to be getting him soon, surely.
Teased at the end of Guardians of the Galaxy. Has the soul gem embedded
soul
in his head?
Or,
well, did in the comic I read, anyway.
In real life, he has it in
his head. Why did that not
head.
Come into the... into the whole plot, and why did he not have to battle Thanos?
I think we'll be coming to that
in
part two.
I mean,
in Infinity War 2, Electric Boogaloo, we'll be looking at that. Mark Hooper, what did you make of Infinity War?
I'm going to be slightly the voice of doom because it wasn't as good as I was expecting it, but partly because I'm kind of like you were saying about Kev, I'm a massive 2000 AD fan and I love like Alan Moore and Watchmen and things like that, but I've never really invested in the whole Marvel films.
You're not a Marvelite.
No, so
you
I've seen
Pete is.
Probably less than half of them, I think. And so for me, it was like a big season finale, but I hadn't been watching the entire series. So there was a lot of cameos and some brilliant cameos and some really brilliantly written, funny. I love the kind of sardonic humour in it and the alpha males trying to outdo each other and group becoming a moody teenager, which was amazing. And weirdly, I thought Guardians of the Galaxy, which is kind of the lightest of all those films, was the one which kind of held it all together. And they were actually, that was kind of core to the whole, I mean, the whole Thanos relationship with his daughter and all that was, I thought, was really good. And weirdly, I found Thanos the most intriguing character and the most, you know, the stony-faced, personality-free, you know, killer who's set up as a kind of straw man. I found him the deepest character in it because they actually explored him. And everyone else was, it's like you already knew these guys. Once they turn up and they disappear and they'll punch each other harder and harder. And I really enjoyed that part of it. And I totally appreciate it. It's a brilliantly made film. But lots of people said, oh, it's so emotional. And I thought, actually, because I wasn't already invested in a lot of those characters already, I don't really care if they die or not, you know. It's like, you know, bits which I know, I know were kind of really shocking. Everyone's gasping in the cinema. I was like,
I'm with Mark here. I wasn't crying when everyone... you know, blew
that's
away.
Well, that's well, we'll get to that. We're going to get to that. We're going to talk about the end in some detail in a moment or two. Ian Dunt, I saw you tweeting that you thought this is the most important exploration of Kantian and utilitarian ethics in movies. Why is that?
I think that's it's quite interesting. By the way, I've only just realised that you're completely right. If he's got all the stones, he can just make more resources. Yeah. He doesn't have to like undo the demand.
Turn
he can
back
just
time.
Increase the supply.
Yeah.
So,
like,
so, but, so actually, to be fair, that is a massive problem, which I had not spotted.
I mean, I know he's a baddie, but...
Yeah,
you know,
but all the way through, he's got this excuse, I'm doing it for good, but he's not, is he? Because he's
that's it. I think that's the power. Yeah.
And then he's going to sit down and watch the sunset at the end.
Well, this is the story. The story
I love that shot, by the way. I thought that was one of the most daring shots I'd seen in mainstream cinema for a really long time, because that was the moment where you suddenly went, oh, fuck me, he's the protagonist.
At home with Thanos.
Yeah, the last scene, well, the way that they use the sunlight, the way they use the expression on his face, you suddenly don't think so much. If you think about the Thor plot, he goes off to the planet, he has to get the weapon, which is going to be used in that final climax, which is exactly what you would expect the thing to do where the heroes win.
Yeah.
And then he just turns around and goes, well, you should have gone for the head, mate, and clicks his fingers. And you're like, oh, fuck me sideways. Yeah, that is an astonishing moment. And then to switch from that to suddenly this scene of him in the sun, that was when I suddenly realised what had just happened to the mechanisms of the plot, that my good guys throughout were basically the bad guys in the way that this was done. Well, this is a Thanos movie. It's not an
every villain Avengers is the good guy. Every villain is the good guy in his story. I think there's a bit of hidden symbolism here. One of the early shots, and this is heavily in the trailer, you see New York upside down, being turned upside down, being turned the right way up, rather. So there's that method. Thanos keeps going on about balance in the universe, resetting the balance. He sees himself as the good guy, and I think we'll be seeing something come through in the next one, which is about... which it's almost like the upside down from Stranger Things. What is the real universe and what is the fake universe? Has Thanos actually destroyed half of the universe? Or have they been sent somewhere else?
Parallel.
Heroes Reborn or the sort of onslaught stuff would be where
we're getting super
that.
Nerd here.
Sorry, they are picking bits up. Can I quickly on that Kantian bit? It's that basically everything that Cap is saying is Kantian sort of ethics. It's basically like the individual is an end, they're not a means. You know? Yeah. So no matter what happens, we defend the individual. It doesn't matter that it's just one guy. Mm. And pretty much everything that Thanos is saying is just pure utilitarianism of, you know, doesn't matter what the hell you have to do, the ends always justify the means. And that clash is a pretty common clash for superhero sort of ethics. So they really like that clash. But I thought it was being explored very, very thoroughly and very, very well here until you pointed out the problem with it just now, and now the whole thing's fallen apart.
I don't think it is a problem, because I think I am doing it for the good of all is Thanos' explanation to himself for why he feels right about pursuing his mad and destructive impulses, because he's not a rational guy with a point. He's a genocidal madman who's told himself he's a rational guy. That all works perfectly.
Is there
going to
be a moment of realization where he's like, actually?
The giant purple hand slaps his head. And says, there's too many people around. We need to get rid of them and put the resources more fairly amongst the population. Thanos is UKIP. Thanos is UKIP, and he's purple with yellow detail. Thanos is UKIP.
Yeah.
Now, Sean Patton. As the representative of normal people who went to see Infinity War with her son, what did you think of the movie?
Well, I have seen a lot of Marvel films now because of my son. We have seen masses, and we've seen quite a few of the Avengers all assembling. And there's one, it's on one of the streaming Avengers Assemble. First hour and a half is them just explaining the plot. There's no action. This one starts with action. Saw it at Picture House. It was too loud. One problem was they ramped up. I was going to phone you. It's really loud, isn't it? It's actually really hurting my ears. So the amount of action that starts, that drew him in. But to me, it was just very loud. There's all the characters. I know most of the characters now, which is really good. But yeah, I'm waiting for the funny bits. I'm waiting for Guardians of the Galaxy cast because I like them
there
and I get on with it.
Quite a few funny bits, weren't there?
Also, Infinity Stones, there's six of them. That didn't work either.
Why?
There should be an infinity amount of them. stuff like that. Why is there only six? Why can't there be 10 or 20? Make it really difficult. I just got lost. I got lost in it, and I got lost in the philosophy, and I didn't really care about the warring philosophies in the end. Individual, state, whatever, UKIP. You know, in the end, it was a lot of people falling over in a very, very loud way. I like that Chris Pratt got trolled on Instagram. When he showed pictures, he's got these sheep, and he's showing his son with all these sheep, and he has sort of 10,000 comments. You failed us. All talking about Avengers Infinity War. It's wonderful. And there he's just trying to show he's got a farm. That was the funniest bit to me. It was just incredible.
So the line that worked most for me is the one, the Captain America line when he's in battle, when I am Groot. I am Groot. Like, I am Steve. That is amazing. And the reason like that line and all of the interactions between sort of say Star-Lord and Spider-Man worked, like when they're talking about Footloose and he's like, is it still the greatest film of all time? He's like, it never was. All of that works because Marvel has this commitment to character
yeah.
that survives no matter the scale of what they're dealing with in the movie.
Hmm.
And because of that, you've got these very, very well-conceived characters, you know, by decades worth of comics, but also by very, very intelligent writing over a series of films. And once you just throw them together, you get all these sparks flying, and it's sort of they almost start writing it by themselves. And I think Marvel deserve a lot of credit for really that level of commitment to character, even when you get to this sort of stage.
There was an infuriating review knocking around in, was it the New Yorker, where that it was like, who are all these characters? I have no idea who they are. People just turn up for no reason at all. You don't know what they're doing. Firstly, do you live in a fucking bin? Have you not seen the movie in the past 15 years? But secondly, it's just wrong, because every single character arrives, announces who they are by their deeds, not by saying, hello, I am Doctor Strange, Master of the Mystic Arts. He turns up and does some Mastery of the Mystic Arts, and also displays his character in interaction with every single one of the other ensemble characters. What I really liked about it was the fact that you knew who everybody was instantly. They did the key character thing that makes them who
they
are.
That's the show, don't tell.
It's quite clever. Introduced themselves to people who would never have crossed paths with them before, and I think they said, what leader do you serve? And he says, what, like Jesus?
And it's the humour that really gives it that little extra. You know, the bit where Steve Rogers and Thor are on the battlefield. It's, so you've had a haircut.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, so you copied my beard.
Yeah, exactly.
You
know,
just stupid stuff that wouldn't happen, but they just chuck it
in. I think Thor Ragnarok took that up to another level. Hopefully they'll keep it there. The great moment where Thor is meeting what is supposed to be the most fearsome creature in the universe in the arena, and it's the Hulk. And he goes, hey, I know him from work.
Yeah.
It's a friend from work. You know, that, it's like you've got these absurdly overpowered, unimaginable beings who still behave a little bit like the people that you know, and stands in such stark contrast to DC movies, which is so joyless.
Also, that the humour that they introduced in the last Star Wars film, which was really badly judged, I felt, compared to this, it works in the Marvel universe.
That's funny. Lots of my friends have said the same thing, but I actually thought that worked in the last Star Wars, and I thought that they'd stolen it from Marvel. These moments and then put humour next to it, and audiences will be all right to keep up with that. But I have to say, I'm in the minority. Definitely most of my friends thought that all of that fell flat. I thought it was very funny.
Well, and it was fun, but I didn't think it sat well with that universe.
I was a teeny bit disappointed. We didn't actually get that much Captain America, and we didn't get any of his Man Out of Time, guy from the 1940s at all, really. That seems to have been sort of lost. And he's one of the most charismatic characters in the whole sort of ensemble.
He got a cheer in my screening, though, when he first popped up. I have to say, he was one of two cheers, him and Thor at the end.
Yeah. Well, Thor...
Oh, Thor at the end is amazing. Well,
let's roll through. Who had a good Infinity War?
Yes.
Tony Stark, proper emoting, gets to be the father figure.
Yeah.
This kind of feckless guy has taken on the responsibilities and is wearing it well. I was kind of hoping he'd die. I was hoping he'd get a proper heroic death.
Yeah, me too.
Maybe we'll get it next time, I don't know. Thor has never been as awesome as this. It was genuine. That is a god. Yeah. Previously been like, kind of, are you really a god, or are you just a guy with crazy hair?
Yeah.
No, but this was a godlike performance, generally amazing. And Bruce Banner as a comic figure, who knew?
Yeah, that was great, actually.
Really funny. Really...
And just never be able to get it up, basically. That's what he did. Back to him. Come on.
But they're going to hold Hulk back for the next one, aren't they, really? Yeah. It's like they're teasing
it. Well, my key objection, the 7-year-old me, nobody can beat the Hulk in a fist fight. Thanos can't beat the Hulk in a fist fight. Hulk is the strongest one there is. This cannot stand.
Yeah,
he's going to have to beat the shit out of Thanos in the next episode.
What I like about it is they're showcasing they're getting older as well.
Yeah.
So they're not in their 20s. Mm. They are losing their powers. The fatal flaw is coming. It's all Greek myth anyway.
It is all Greek
myth. And we're following their journey with them getting older too. So it's like, I'm getting this.
Which brings me to the character I thought was best in the whole movie. Was Peter Quill, Star-Lord, because that's the emotional core of the whole thing.
Yeah.
And as we know, because we've all seen it, because the spoilers in this bit of the show, Gamora is murdered by Thanos to gain the Soul Stone. And this kind of, happy-go-lucky doofusy guy who once saved the planet with a dance-off is confronted with actual real death and real tragedy. And it's kind of heartbreaking. I thought it was an amazing performance.
Okay. The bit that broke me was Spider-Man.
Well, let's talk about that ending, because it is incredibly bleak. And I watched it up in Wood Green amongst the civilian populace. And there were a lot of little kids there, and they'd come in their Spider-Man and their Captain America outfits. And they were just, they came up with a 1,000-yard stare. It's like
the end of Empire, isn't it, basically?
Yeah, but at the end of Empire, you thought, well, there is a bit of hope here somewhere. Yeah. But this is like, your favourite people are all dead.
Yeah.
They're all dead.
Yeah, my kids are like, they killed Black Panther.
Yeah.
What? Mm-hmm. And Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm. You can't kill them. But I really like the way they paced that, because it started off with, Winter Soldier dies, and you think, oh, well, that could be a tragedy.
Yeah.
But it kind of went up the rankings until people that you think these are essential parts of this universe are dying before our eyes. Or, and I thought it was beautifully done in that, like, people don't explode or collapse. Yeah, yes. But it's autumn. Autumn comes and the leaves take them away. It was Ingmar Bergman's Infinity War.
I've seen a thousand memes where people are now just blowing away in imagery. It's going
to... But we know that external to the plot of the movie, we know for financial reasons Black Panther is coming back as
Spider-Man.
They're all coming back, so they're all going to have to come back. But before we talk about the mechanics of that, the idea of saying to a generation of quite young kids, this is the big moment of your pop culture life, and rather than give you a glowing moment of triumph, we're going to give you absolute tragedy and death. It's like it's the end of Blackadder. Yeah. It's Butch and Sundance. I think that is really brave and kind of quite shocking.
It's very brave. And everyone is coming back to see part two next year. You know, they're going to have the second biggest opening weekend ever, aren't they?
Well, Thanos, the character is derived from the artist Jim Starlin's study of Freudian psychology. And Thanatos is the death instinct. Thanatos is what draws you to death. Oh. It's Thanatos is the voice at the back of your head when you're standing by a railway line that says jump in front of the train, or that voice that instinct to destruction. And in the comics, Thanos is doing it all because he's in love with the female personification of death. He's doing it all for a girl, just to impress a girl, like all these crazy guys do. And I think I think we may see some of that unwinding in the next one, that actually Thanos is not really doing this in order to make Deliveroo get round a bit more quickly because he doesn't have to go into too many houses. He's doing it because of an infatuation with the fanatic death instinct, which is going to be heavy.
There's a brilliant bit when he was on Titan where he shows them what the world used to be like, and he said, I've purged this world and now, and it's a desolate wasteland, which is a brilliant moment because it's like, what are you doing? Yeah. It's not really worked, has it?
It's kind of a fixer-upper Thanos, Tonally, it's about the defeat you didn't imagine could possibly happen. Mm. Hence all the In the Age of Trump think pieces. Absolutely everything that comes out now has got to be In the Age of Trump, But it's like, it's the good guys are defeated by not doing the unspeakable thing that they knew they had to do. Mm. Basically, chop off the Vision's head and everything's fine. And they can't get back to camp. They can't do it. And it's their goodness is their weakness, which is, that's now. Our goodness is our weakness. Yeah. Our commitment to free speech is what destroys our politics. Our commitment to argument allows us to be destroyed by things. Thanos is UKIP.
Yeah. And then they do it, and it still makes no difference. And and it owes quite a lot to Jonathan Hickman's run on the Avengers, specifically an event called Infinity, which is going to pick up just this crushing sense of inevitability. Defeat that is just impacting on heroes, and that actually plays into something that works quite well to keep heroes alive and keep them relevant, especially heroes like Captain America, who are always on the verge of being treated as if they're irrelevant, which is to basically take this sort of moral purity and create the circumstances that will just crush them and crush them and crush them until you get to something interesting at the end. I think by that they managed to do that really very well. I mean, the point where she does actually, he has a beautiful line to the Scarlet Witch, where he's like, it shouldn't have to be you, but it has to be you. The cruel irony of that was so much. And then for her to do it, and then for it to be meaningless, was my God, the waves of despair that you're slapping me around with right now.
Yeah.
Really, really, really gutsy.
But then they just bring it back with Thor, and there's hope again, and then you should have gone for the head. Damn.
Now, let's get into the mechanics of this, because clearly, how are they going to get out of that? And they are going to get out of that, maybe not fully intact, but there's Infinity War Part 2, whatever it's going to be called, coming up. What are we betting on? Come on.
Well, there's the Doctor Strange thing, isn't there? He's seen the one way and he's given the stone. So that's obviously part of it.
Yeah, he says very early on in the film, I would not hesitate to let you all die rather than let him have the stone. Yeah. And he's given Thanos the time stone.
Yes.
So clearly there's a plan here.
And he didn't let Tony Stark die. So whatever that plan is that he saw...
Yeah, Tony's part of the solution somehow.
Yeah. So the time stone is going to be part of the key to the whole thing. I have a suspicion. You mentioned Adam Warlock and the Soul Stone. Mm. Now, in the comics, the Soul Stone is evil. The Soul Stone is not...
There's two Adam Warlocks, isn't there? The good and evil, isn't there? Or is it the Magus?
The Magus is future Adam Warlock.
That's it.
People turning off the podcast in their millions now. Shut up, you nerds.
But I read this.
When I talk about tariffs.
Yeah.
It's basically the exact same thing.
It is, yeah.
Back to the plot of Star Wars.
Yeah. And all the Romaniacs listeners are going, what has happened to Ian? But the Soul Stone is... The Infinity Stones are not morally neutral. Some of them are bad. The Soul Stone is a vampiric thing. It sucks in souls. Yes. You remember this from Adam Warlock.
They're all inside the souls.
Yeah, he's got this thing stuck in his head, which is a kind of a parasite that gives him his power, but it sucks in the souls of innocent people. It also contains an idyllic pocket universe. Who's sitting in an idyllic universe at the end of the movie with the sun on him? Thanos.
Thanos.
So, that moment, he snaps his fingers. The screen goes white. Then Thanos is in a kind of a void speaking to young Gamora.
Mm.
Or is it young Gamora? We don't know. He's in some abstract space and then he's kind of resting as a job well done.
Mm.
I have a theory that what we have seen is not what we have seen. That's, it's getting deep 2000 AD here. Do you remember Zenith? Yeah. Remember how Zenith ended? There's one of the great comic endings.
Didn't
where
they die?
Well, the ending is the universe has been destroyed and it turns out that months ago, weeks ago, the bad guys were trapped inside a perfect facsimile of the universe by clever Peter St. John. And this tragedy has played out, but it's all harmless and meaningless. You should see the face on Sean right now. Say, who are you people?
There's another end of the universe. And then the universe ended. Yeah. There are films where and comics where the universe doesn't end. I know it's infinity. Yeah.
My nephew's amazing theory is that you've not seen those characters die. The universe has been split into two. And at the beginning of the next one, you will see that scene replayed, except it won't be Spider-Man who dies, it'll be Captain America who fades away before Spider-Man's eyes.
Oh.
So everyone we've seen is dying. It's going to be, you know, I'm really holding out for the heroic death of Captain America and the heroic death of Iron Man and Thor. I actually think that would be an amazing thing to see. Kill them and have them have them die for a real reason.
All three?
Yeah.
Fucking hell, I wouldn't recover for weeks.
Yeah, but they're bringing in so many more. I mean, now that Fox has been bought by Disney, isn't it? They're getting Fantastic Four.
Yep.
Which means Galactus, Silver Surfer,
Doctor Doom.
They're making a Doctor Doom film.
C-3PO.
Oh, hello.
Oh God, crossover.
My favourite films are the cosmic ones, the Guardians of the Galaxy, Thor, Ragnarok. You know, I think they do that better than anyone.
Yeah.
And more of that, please. More Galactus battling Thanos or something. That's not going to happen for the second one.
I'm also holding out for Adam Warlock because I think that's an amazing... Yes. That's basically Golden Space Jesus.
Yes.
Goes through the Stations of the Cross.
And with Doctor Strange, I mean, Benedict Cumberbatch absolutely owned that character in the film for me. He's just perfect. And I thought the first Doctor Strange film was good. You know, visually wise, it was amazing, but it was more of a setup sort of thing. And he really came into it. And he's got a sort of gravity to it now.
Yeah. Do we think we're going to watch the next one? I think so.
Oh, yeah.
I think so. And of course, Ant-Man and the Wasp is coming on soon. So, you know, hooray, with Black Goliath, which I'm so pleased about. Anyway, poor old Sean is climbing the walls here. The time stone on my Infinity Oven glove is glowing, which means the show is nearly over. And that deep fried kebab is ready to eat. And that means closing time chatter. What will our guests be discussing over a foaming horn of mead in Valhalla this weekend? Strictly Kev.
Mine's Brian May, who is obviously lead guitarist of Queen and a famous astronomer, but also the collector of the biggest collection of stereo photos in the country.
Stereo photos?
Possibly in the world, actually.
Yeah.
Do you know what stereo photos are? Mm. They're basically a left and right eye thing where a camera takes a slightly different angled photo of somebody and you view it through some special glasses and it looks like a 3D thing. It's 3D photography, basically. It goes back to the mid-1800s and has been a fad here and there, and he's got a new book out called Queen in 3D. He's been taking photos since he was 12 in 3D.
It's and, like you can touch the thread.
Yes. And he's got an exhibition of these at the Lomography store on New Bourke Street starting, well, it would have opened by the time this podcast goes out.
Amazing. Mark Hooper, what have you got?
Weirdly, I was, you know, this kind of strange sort of thawing of relations in Korea and kind of been thinking about where that all came from. And there's a lot of talk at the moment, like, has Trump played his Trump card? Now, has he actually played a blinder here and people need to give him credit, or is he being played himself? And it's, no one's quite sure what's going on and how it's going to pan out. And I was just thinking, like, what happened to Dennis Rodman? He used to turn up and hang out with King all the whole time. And I was thinking, maybe he's been, like, talking, and he's got this kind of Janelle Monáe, you know, pleasure principle about things.
Yeah.
You know, he stands for everything which North Korea opposes, you know. It's like freedom of expression, liberty, inclusivity,
having a different haircut to the guy who runs the country,
piercing anything you can. And it's just like he's had this kind of really weird American buddy for years talking in his ear, and he's a big basketball fan, so like maybe Dennis Rodman's responsible for saving the world.
Thanks, Dennis. Ian, off the top of your head, have you got a closing time chatter that you'll be enlightening people with over the weekend in pubs?
I saw Funny Cow the other day, which is really, really very, very good. And it's not doing particularly well, and I can see why, because it's hard to see who it's really aimed at. And I don't think it's going to have any legs internationally, but it's a truly quite extraordinary piece of work, of which the only phrase I could come up with was this sort of stark empathy.
Excellent. Sean, closing time chatter.
Well, I'm just I can't stop looking at Matt Cardle's 24 Hours... What I Ate in a Day in Waitrose magazine, which has gone out to a lot of people because it's free. Matt Cardle apparently won the X Factor at some point many years ago, and is one of those people you see the biog in Pound Shop quite a lot. And obviously the PR's gone, it's great, I've got you this bit of press. It's Waitrose magazine. Just hundreds of thousands of people are going to read it, and they're all going to buy your new album. And he prosaically lists every single thing he's eaten and drunk in a day. But there's something, because it is so workmanlike, when he's talking about his fish paste and his piri piri chicken, and then he's washing things down with a glass of red wine, that I really warmed to him, and the prosaic nature became poetry to me, and I still can't stop looking at it. It's still available till Thursday. If you pass a Waitrose, go in and grab one.
As he lived his life like a cardle in the wind.
That's like a Marquis Smith lyric, doesn't it? That's an interesting.
I think this whole thing is probably like a full song if you do it in the right inflection.
Yeah, Marquis Smith just read out an interview with Pete Tong as a lyrical one. I've got a computer, it doesn't work properly. So my closing time chatter is Michelle Wolf versus the Washington Press Corps. I think the American press has thrown away everything that is earned in covering Trump so forensically and so well. It's flung it all away in pursuit of a kind of a shallow idea of decorum. Oh, she said some offensive things at our press dinner. You know, she's not the first comedian to really go after members of an administration really below the belt at a Washington Press Association dinner, and there's never been an administration that has deserved it so much as this. And instead, rather than defending the person they've hired to entertainment, what does the Washington Press Corps do? It trots out the coward's word, inappropriate. Oh, it was inappropriate. I thought it was despicable. They threw her under the bus. She's a fantastic comedian, and everything that she said in that routine, she clearly meant it. I think she didn't go far enough. Her final line should have been, "They weren't jokes. I meant every single word of it. Enjoy the veal." And it shows the absolute cowardice and complicity of a press that, you know, I think the American press has done a fantastic job by and large in covering Trump. The print press has stood as a counterpoint to a completely compromised broadcast press, and particularly Fox News. But this is just feeble and pathetic, and they ought to be ashamed. Oh, that's my closing time chapter. So ending the show on a happy, smiling note as usual.
Right.
So that's the end of the show. Thanks to our special guest, Strictly Kev. What are you up to next?
I'm DJing at Blade Runner Secret Cinema.
Oh, blimey, wow. When?
I'm not allowed to tell you, it's a secret.
Oh, God, hence the name. Right, okay.
A weekend,
all right. Ooh, that sounds good. I presume you'll be going to be vangelising the shit out of it?
They actually want Acid House quite a lot.
Oh, my God. I have to go.
I can't tell you why, but...
Well, Acid House is correct at all times and all events. Mark Cooper, what are you up to next? Crafting?
Yeah, I've actually got to look through some BFI archives, which is quite fun, because part of this event we've got coming up, we're showing a sort of series of films, and we're borrowing some films from them, so that's quite good. So they've given us like a long list of, like, you can have any of these 12, so I'm going to go through them. Like, lots of brilliant old black and white photos of strange people doing weird things.
Fantastic.
Good afternoon.
Amazing. Obviously, cameo appearance from Ian Dunn. I know what you're doing next. John Romaniacs this afternoon.
You bastards. Yeah. No
escape. With Femi Oluwale of OFOC and Billy Bragg. It's the biggest ensemble crossover in history. Who lives? Who dies? You know what it's like to fail. So Dunn will be putting on the Romaniac glove and putting his Brexit stones in place. Thanks to everybody for coming. Do come back whenever you like. Thanks as ever to Sean Pattenden, the proximum midnight to my Corvus glaive, and to producer Jack Claremont, the Willy Lumpkin in this particular Baxter building. Don't forget, you can hear this show and all of our past episodes again at audioboom.com/bigmouth. If you want to support the show with an invisible virtual pint, you can buy it via patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast. Thanks for listening. See you all next week, and listen to the rustling as our guests disappear in a cloud of leaves.